Support for WERU comes from Inner Tapestry, New England's holistic publication supporting people in their discovery of spiritual wisdom, holistic health, green living, and the celebration of life. Featuring articles, calendar listings, and a directory of community resources, available in print and online at innertapestry.org. Support for WERU also comes from Quantum Insulators of Belfast, serving Midcoast Maine as spray foam specialists, licensed dealers of the Isonine portfolio of spray foam products, including commercial and residential applications with renewable and recyclable content. More information at quantuminsulators.com or 338-3077.
It's 10 o'clock and you are tuned to WERU-FM, 89.9 Blue Hill, 99.9 Bangor, and streaming online at weru.org. Common Ground Radio with your hosts from MAFCA is up next.
Good morning and welcome to Common Ground, an hour on local food and agriculture hosted by the Maine Organic Farmers and Gardeners Association. My name is Melissa White Pillsbury. I'm the Organic Marketing Coordinator at MAFCA and your host for today's show. This is a monthly show airing on the first Friday of every month at 10 a.m. here on WERU. We're open to suggestions on future show topics and guests, so please contact us with your thoughts and ideas through our website, www.mafca.org. The days are getting longer and ever so slightly warmer, although today is still feeling rather wintry. But spring is coming, and I find my thoughts turning more and more to the greener days to come. So in preparation of the upcoming gardening season, for today's show, we're going to explore ecological gardening, both principles and practices around that idea. And joining us today to share their knowledge and answer your questions, although it'll be by email and not by phone, about how to design and manage your garden from an ecological perspective are Peter Beckford and Bill Erickson. Peter and his wife Julie own Rebel Hill Farm in Clifton, where they grow certified organic perennial flowers and shrubs with an emphasis on native plants. And Bill and his wife Lauren own Singing Nettle Farm in Brooks, where they grow certified organic vegetables, fruits, flowers, culinary and medicinal herbs, and nursery stock. And they also own or operate a permaculture design and consultation business. I've invited Peter and Bill to join us today to talk about approaching gardening in a way that enhances and utilizes the biological and other natural systems and relationships that are ever present in the natural world, whether we notice them or not. And we hope that you, our listeners, will contact us with your questions. You're probably aware that the listener number to call in is not available, but you can email your question to info@weru.org and we'll get them that way. So you can start doing that anytime. Ecological gardening questions, send them to info@weru.org. But before we begin today's conversation with our guests, I first like to share some seasonal items of interest about what's going on in the Maine organic food and agriculture world. There's a lot going on in the events arena this month, so I'm going to try to cover the highlights. The first and most timely is an exciting event that's happening in different parts of the state today, starting today and going through the weekend, called Meet Your Farmers and Fishermen. It's a celebration of community-supported agriculture and fisheries, and these events are part of part celebration and part education. As local farmers, fishermen, and other food producers come together with community members to encourage them to support local foods businesses in a meaningful way through a commitment to through a community-supported kind of arrangement, which usually is a prepaid share or some kind of commitment in the beginning of a season that then is returned over the course of the season. Each location of this event will have plenty of local flavor, whether it's live music, tastings, sales of food and other products, film screenings. Each event is a little bit different, and there are 10 locations, with the closest to the station being in Belfast at the Belfast Boathouse on Sunday afternoon, and in Bangor at the Hammond Street Congregational Church on Saturday afternoon. So to find the location nearest you, you can visit our website, mafca.org. Also in upcoming events, particularly apropos of our discussion today, there is a 3-hour introductory course on organic gardening that MOFCA helps organize and sponsor every year called Grow Your Own Organic Garden. And we partner with adult education programs around the state. And this year we're offering the course in 37 locations, which has to be an all-time high because that's just amazing that we're coordinating with that many different places to put this course on. So in 37 locations around the state, there has to be one near you. Or tell your friends and neighbors who you'd like to see get into gardening or garden in a more natural, organic way. Most of the events will take place on the evening of Wednesday, April 3rd. But please check with your local adult education office or MOFCA's website for details on the course available nearest to you. Some of them are happening on different days than that April 3rd date. We also have several organic orcharding workshops coming up this month, thanks to MOFCA's organic orchardist CJ Walk. He'll be doing an introductory course the evening of March 5th in Belfast. And then there will be a pruning workshop on March 16th. And there's two locations for that one, in both Unity and Jefferson, and actually a third location, but on a different date, on the 23rd, closer to here in Blue Hill. That's a pruning workshop. And then later in the month, on the 30th, there's going to be an organic orcharding workshop on the theme of renovating old apple trees. So if any of you have old orchards out there, you might be particularly interested in that one. And that one is actually happening in two locations as well. One location is in Gardner, and the other one is at Beech Hill Farm on MDI. MOFCA's organic crop specialist, Eric Seidman, will be teaching an organic pest management class on March 10th in Brunswick. And he'll be offering his 2-day organic principles and practices course on the 21st and the 28th in Falmouth. And that's a course that he offers every year, and he's an excellent instructor. So if you're interested in getting serious about organic farming, you definitely want to try to sign up for that. And finally, on March 30th, MOFCA will be hosting our annual Spring Growth Conference. And this year, the conference theme is on growing garlic. So if you're interested in learning more about growing garlic, you should come to that one-day conference at our education center in Unity. And again, more details and event registration information are all available on our website. I'd like to remind you that you're listening to Common Ground, an hour on local food and agriculture hosted by MOFCA. And for today's show, we're talking about ecological gardening. We're taking questions from listeners today by email. Please send them to info@weru.org. And in the meantime, we'll start chatting with our guests today. In the studio, we have with us Peter Beckford from Rebel Hill Farm in Clifton and Bill Erickson from Singing Nettle Farm in Brooks. Thank you both very much for joining us today. I'd like to start with asking you to each of you to kind of introduce yourselves from this from the perspective of this topic and what you do, how you got started doing it, and big plans for the year, if you have any. Bill, you want to start?
Thanks, Melissa, and thanks for having me on the show. My background is in biology and soil science, and it's my 10th year involved working in agriculture and the 4th year of operating Singing Nettle Farm with my wife, Lauren. And for me, I see this work as really a practical application of integrating humans into the ecosystem. So how do we affect the ecosystem in a positive way? And to me, it's not only a science, but there's an art to it, a creativity, a level of physical shape that we have to be in. You have to be attentive. There's community development and marketing and a political resistance piece to organic farming as well. And so it keeps me interested, to say the least. So Singing Nettle Farm is a horse-powered and off-grid certified organic farm. We grow primarily vegetables, nursery stock, medicinal herbs and flowers, and seed garlic. And we provide those to a CSA, the Brooks Farmers Market, Ralph's Cafe, the Common Ground Fair, local schools, and FedCro Trees. And then we also operate a permaculture design business where we'll come out and do site visits, and we can write up reports and do full designs for either residential clients or businesses, schools we've worked with before. Big plans for this future, I think, are to just have a good handle on things and to, you know, to try to take care of everything really well, not get spread too thin, and give everything really the best care we can.
Thanks.
Hi, Melissa.
Hi.
I got into gardening, you know, when I was in college, and just loved gardening, loved vegetables and vegetable farming, and did a Mofco apprenticeship. And
where'd you do your apprenticeship?
At Wallace Organic Farm in Leeds. Bud and Barb Wallace were some of the first Mofco farmers. Certainly, he might have been like one of the two or three first large ones, and they were great farmers. So, gardening was something I loved, and it was clear you couldn't be doing much harm if you were a gardener or a farmer, at least the way organic farmers do it. So that's how I got going. We kind of got into perennial flowers because it was a way to farm on a really small piece of tillable land. And we love it. And in the last 10 or so years, we've focused on natives because we love that even more than just the general perennial scene. We like getting out in nature and seeing the plants that we're raising, you know, on hikes. And we like learning about the biology of the insects and the relationship between insects and birds and the plants. And it sure does fit right in with lifestyle and, you know, a healthy political system, maybe, as Bill was saying.
Mm-hmm. Oh. So today we're talking about ecological gardening. You know, we hear organic gardening a lot, or sustainable, or, you know, a lot of other words, but it's not as common, I don't think, to hear people talking about ecological gardening. So I wanted to talk about it today because it's really kind of, or it's what a lot of people, I think, refer to as deep organic, but, you know, really thinking about the systems that support the growing that you're trying to do. So I think it's an important topic, and one that, you know, probably should be more forefront in our conversations about the right kind of how to grow food and, you know, what we believe is the right way. So that's why I wanted to have this discussion today, and thank you both for being here to have it. So, Bill, maybe you can talk a little bit more about permaculture and how that addresses a lot of those ecological considerations.
Sure. You know, in permaculture, it's really about, I think, creating a human ecology and how humans can integrate into being a positive and productive member of the ecosystem. So when we're doing our design work, one of the first questions that we'll ask to one of our clients is, what are your goals? So we're starting from the human perspective. And sometimes those goals are more food production, wildlife habitat, less lawn. Usually it's a combination of all of these things and more. So the second step then is we look at the landscape and see what already exists there. We do a site analysis, and we look at the characteristics such as sun and wind angles, any water issues, slope, soil type, existing vegetation. And then from there, we look at sort of zones of influence in the landscape. Where do you visit most often in the day? Where do you pay most of your human attention, and what areas sort of receive less attention than others? So then our job as designers is to try to synthesize all of these things together, the human goals, the landscape characteristics, and the zones of influence in trying to create an efficient, productive, and biodiverse agroecosystem, basically trying to reintegrate humans into a natural and productive ecosystem.
And is there a scale at which the permaculture philosophy becomes less effective? So I think of permaculture usually in the context of someone's landscape around their home, but can permaculture principles be applied at a larger scale, like a farm scale?
The principles actually derive from native cultures that, you know, in South America and in North America, you know, there are theories that this whole continent was managed as a food forest with chestnut trees and game trails and supporting wildlife habitat that supported people. So permaculture is actually derived from modeling those systems and observing nature. It's sort of, you know, things like lasagna gardening and raised beds and things get associated with it. But the idea of a permanent agriculture or a permanent human culture, the concept is sort of bigger than that. It takes more people and more organization and skill to operate on that level, but it is certainly possible.
Mm-hmm. And is it your belief that the production level can be such that it could, you know, be a viable business as well as what, you know, you're doing the right thing for the environment, obviously, but can that approach also be productive and efficient from that priority perspective?
Yeah, and I think it's really about biodiversity, not only in your system, but also in your marketing and in your products that you're trying to provide. So in permaculture, something we work with is an integrated orchard. So it's not just, say, apple trees you're growing, but it's apples and maybe bush cherries for a shrub layer of fruit, and then medicinal herbs as a ground level understory, and plants that are providing for the soil and pollinating insects and beneficial insects as well. So you have a diverse product offering that spans the course of the season. And if one crop isn't doing so well, you have another to fill that in. And then you also have labor saving of sort of pest issues as the ecosystem gets into balance. You know, the beneficial insects will take care of your pest issues. Plants will naturally build the fertility of the soil. And so we're putting a human influence out in the beginning to create a system that will ultimately maintain itself, similar to the forest. I mean, we have huge trees that we don't water them, we don't fertilize them, they take care of themselves. And the forest is an ecosystem that is productive and maintains itself and supports a lot of life.
Great. Peter, how about your approach to, I don't know if you have a permaculture background, but I'd love to hear more about approach to garden design.
I sure don't. I don't know much about permaculture, but the more I hear about it, it's like, oh, that's what I believe in. That's kind of what we're doing.
New name for an old concept, maybe.
Maybe, parts of it, anyways. We're providing perennial plants primarily for home gardeners. If they could go to a greenhouse and find native plants and know what the native plants were and have help from the greenhouse people selecting the great native plants, that would be wonderful. It isn't that way. It's actually even hard to get nurseries to carry a lot of them because there isn't a lot of demand for them. So we're promoting native plants by growing them and just pushing them out there and talking about them, encouraging people to make their garden part of nature instead of maybe like a piece of art or a plant zoo, or sometimes home gardens aren't much more than parking lots as far as their relationship to nature. There's some color there, and that's about it. So we're encouraging people to grow native plants, put them in their garden, and understand some of the basics, like it's heavier. I mean, it's healthier to have plants living where they evolved. You know, grow main plants in your garden rather than Japanese barberry or something, and you'll be healthier, and all the critters and insects and birds will be healthier, and you'll be a part of nature. And when you go out in bona fide nature, hiking, you know, you'll feel more at home.
Mm-hmm. Can you talk more about the educational approach you take? I mean, is it mostly just direct conversations with your customers or with your
Julie
your
does
greenhouse?
Lectures, for one thing. Mm-hmm. It's pure education. She's an expert. She understands the botany completely and the web of life. And so that's one way. We do a few plant sales, like we do one through the Belfast Co-op, where all we offer is natives. We're going to be selling plants through a plant sale at the Coastal Maine Botanical Gardens, and they're great, you know, down in Booth Bay. They're great with natives because they got Bill Kleiner there, who's America's expert. They have a lot of other plants too, but they're great with natives. But as far as people's access to Maine-grown natives, we're pretty much it, not exclusively, but so I guess that's how we're trying to educate. You know, when people go to a plant sale and 90% of them are natives, they might recognize a few of them, but they'll take some home and they'll have learned something.
What are the main points that you try to drive home for people about the benefits of using native plants in your
One
landscape.
Of the first thing we think about is the critters, like caterpillars. If you've got trees and shrubs in your yard and there aren't holes in the leaves, something's wrong. You know, if you look up into your, you know, shade tree in August and it isn't just littered with holes like an oak tree is, it looks beautiful, you know, but then if you really look, there's holes all over those leaves. Something's wrong. So provide a home for caterpillars and the birds that eat them. These caterpillars have done so much to evolve to the point where they can actually eat these leaves that are disgusting. If you try eating leaves, nothing eats leaves. You know, squirrels aren't eating leaves. Caterpillars are eating them because they've evolved that way, and the leaves have evolved to not be eaten, and the birds have evolved somehow that they can eat the caterpillars, which are fairly toxic from the leaves. I mean, the monarch butterflies is the perfect example. You know, they feed on milkweed. The caterpillars feed on milkweed, and birds don't eat those caterpillars because they're toxic. And the monarch butterflies are completely dependent on milkweed. And that's just a gorgeous native plant. I mean, there's no shortage of beauty in Maine natives. So you can have them in your garden, and you can have parts of your garden taken over by milkweed. Great. It's a food plant, right, Bill? I'm pretty sure it is. Parts of it, at certain times of the year, if you boil it enough, you're eating it. And so, you know, that's not an invasive plant. It spreads and stuff, but it's not your, you know, invasive that you hear about.
So you're up against a lot of prevailing perceptions from customers or consumers about what is desirable in a garden. The not having holes in the leaves is a very good example.
Sure, or just getting stuck.
The Roundup, you know, I don't know, call it a disease, you know, almost in the perception of the public that you have to try to kill everything, and which is a totally, you know, to try to get this pristine garden where it's much more difficult, and it requires a lot more knowledge to approach gardening and building an intentional landscape where you are embracing the complexity of all of these interrelationships.
Yes, yeah, right. They're interrelated. Those plants are in a community. It's not like this plant and, you know, daylily, that looks really nice next to this, you know, Japanese iris or something. It's like, no, we're encouraging plant communities. If you go out to Little Moose in Acadia or any, maybe a rich woodlands, you'll see the plant community. And you can actually try to create that community depending on your conditions that you're gardening in.
You mentioned the botanical garden. Do they do any gardens that are devoted, or any other gardens in Maine that are devoted specifically to highlighting or raising the profile, I guess, of using natives in Maine landscapes?
Well, I don't know. They've got their Coastal Maine Botanical Gardens in Booth Bay. But if you wanted to learn about natives by going to visit a garden, that'd be a good place. There's a lot of non-natives because, you know, they're kind of exotic and fun for people to see, I guess. But, yeah, they're native plant experts.
Another, I'll do a little reminder that we're listening. You're listening. I'm not listening. I'm speaking. But you're listening to Common Ground, an hour on local food and agriculture, hosted by Maine Organic Farmers and Gardeners Association. Today we're talking about ecological gardening. We have two guests in the studio with me. We have Peter Beckford from Rebel Hill Farm in Clifton and Bill Erickson from Singing Nettle Farm in Brooks. And we're not taking calls today because the phone line is down, but we do welcome your questions by email, which you can send to info@weru.org. And we'll just keep on chatting away here. Slight change in topic here is climate change increasing irregularities in weather patterns, or the combination of the two. How does that affect or come into play, I guess, in the work you do, or have you made observations over the years about how a changing climate is changing the ecosystem that you work with?
Yeah, I mean, every season is different for sure, and it always has been, but we have, you know, really wet years, dry years, we're getting stronger storms and winds, and I think that the message to it all is that we need to build resilience into our gardens, because the seasons are unpredictable. So, you know, a lot of biodiversity in the vegetable gardens, making sure we have enough diversity of crops and something to eat. Rugged perennial fruit and nut species, I think, are important to focus on. You know, two examples being Jerusalem artichoke and groundnut. They get a bad rap for spreading, but they're two native edible perennial tubers. And if you have a really hard year with crop failures, these are some things that are going to be reliable and, you know, they've probably kept people alive before, kept civilizations alive, having staple crops and, you know, things that are reliable in the ground. I think building up soil fertility is really important for some of the resilience, because plants that are healthier can withstand more severe fluctuations in weather, pest and disease attacks and things like that. And then also, we sort of hedge our bets sometimes. We're taking a little bit of a chance and planting some species that are right on the edge of our cold hardiness zone in preparation for a warming climate. So maybe we'll plant something like a hardy pecan or a Japanese heartnut. And so these trees, you know, they can survive in our area. They're sort of right on the line. But the season might not be long enough to ripen their nuts. So in 10 years, when they're bearing nuts, we're going to, you know, hopefully, one way or the other, if those nuts are ripening, we might be very grateful that we planted some trees 10 years ago that are now producing. And so it doesn't always work. So you can't be afraid to lose a few plants and, you know, don't plant your whole garden with things that are sort of pushing the envelope for hardiness zones, but it's a way that we can prepare and start to incorporate some more diversity. If plant species are going to change based on the way the climate goes, we can try and stay ahead of that curve a little bit.
Pete, sort of on this topic, have you observed non-native species becoming increasingly competitive over the years, or maybe not just competitive, but just present, or certain maybe species that were more, used to be more marginal because of increasingly warmer average temperatures?
No, I can't say I have. I mean, there are certainly non-native species that are becoming more of a drag just over time. You know, it mm-hmm. might take them 50 years to get the speed up, and then, you know, then it's a real problem. I mean, purple loosestrife is an obvious one. You know, I wouldn't say it has much to do with climate change. It's more to do with globalization at this point. Mm-hmm. Yeah, mm-hmm. But you know, we're gonna lose a lot. We're gonna lose, you know, sugar maples. You know, it's for instance, you know, who knows? Oaks and hemlocks could be on the ropes. As far as climate change goes, one of the things we talk about related to gardening is encouraging people to preserve a space, give nature as much a break as you can. You know, if our climate is really going to get ruined, as far as I'd say, you know, what do you want to go down with nature or not? It's one of the ways we look at it.
We did get a question emailed to us, thanks to Yo in Tremont. I'll just read it. Can you talk about garlic nematodes and certification? Also, what conditions tend to reduce the formation of skin, allowing dirt to accumulate between the cloves? So, Bill, you mentioned growing garlic for seed, so... Do you like to take a stab at Yo's question? I'll put it in front of you so you can remind yourself.
Sure.
And Pete, do you have experience growing garlic?
We've grown garlic a long time, and we don't know much about it.
Okay. We'll let Bill
know. Although I'm not going to claim to know much about it either, but I know that nematodes are, you know, increasing problem coming up in this area, and farms are finding it in their fields, and it is a problem if you're buying seed garlic or if you're saving your own stock. There is a testing service now available, I believe, through the University of Maine, where you can send samples of your garlic in, and they will tell you if you have it. So some people will either test by variety or by field section or such. We haven't seen any evidence of it in our fields thus far. We are going to test this year just to give our customers a reassurance that we don't have it, but it hasn't been a problem for us. And the second part of the question, what conditions tend to reduce the formation of skin, allowing dirt to accumulate between the cloves? That could probably be a number of things. One might be leaving it in the ground too long is something that I might guess. You know, you want to get it out of the ground before the skin really starts to decay. When about half of the leaves have turned yellow above ground, we pull it out and set it to cure. And the other thing could be any number of pathogens affecting garlic. I think there's about a dozen or more things that can attack garlic, and they appear different ways on the cloves, but reducing, you know, eating away at the skin is something characteristic of many of them.
I had another thought about maybe gardening in hot, dry conditions. Say we're going to get hot and dry here for a few summers in a row or something. One of the things that I think about is the prairies. There are great native prairie plants. They're not native to Maine, but they're not possibly, it's impossible that they would be invasive too. Like Echinacea, Helenium, all the native sunflowers, Heliopsis, these grow great in our climate. They're totally reliably hardy, and they can take it really dry. Other really deep-rooted plants, like, say, Vernonia or milkweed, even can take it dry. The other thing is grow perennials, not annuals. You know, a thick root mass isn't going to take much water, you know. I mean, some summers we never water our perennials, and we're planting them even as seedlings or whatever. We're planting them and mulching them, and that's it. And certainly the plants that are there from the year before don't need to get watered. Just a thought.
That brings up an interesting aspect of a closed system of water management. So perennial systems, much less need for water. What can you speak, Bill, to an annual system and whether or not you can be so good as to not, or how to minimize the need, I guess, for watering even in an annual system?
Yep, and it depends on a lot of factors. You know, again, each season is different, and every piece of land is different, and soil types have a lot to do with that. So we farm on Marlow and Tunbridge Lyman soils, which are nice, well-drained, sandy loam soils, which is great for getting on the fields early. And we don't have a lot of moisture collecting in the fields, but in a dry year, the fields tend to dry out. So there's a few different approaches that we can take to try to keep water in the landscape for as long as we want. One is that we lay out our beds on contour. So, going perpendicular to the slope of the land, if you looked at a topographic map and you saw contour rings of, coming down a mountain, that's a way to lay out your garden beds. And we dig swales there sort of on the uphill side of the bed. So water will collect there and seep into the ground and slowly infiltrate as the plants need it. So we're trying to stop the water from running through the land and keep it there as long as possible. We also utilize mulch, so wood chips for pathways and around fruit trees and perennials and such, and straw in the beds. For our annuals, we do some drip irrigation as well. We have it as backup for dry years, and we're off-grid, so we run that with a solar pump. And use gravity to feed the drip lines.
Great. This question is for either of you. Can you talk more about your approach to soil fertility, soil structure, just basically soil husbandry, and how does that consideration come into play with the things that are above the ground?
I'll go first. It'll probably be a little briefer. We make a lot of compost. We really get into it. We do it by hand, and we use cow manure and leftover stuff from our perennials. And so that, and we also put just the straight cow manure into the beds, which is easier for us to do than vegetable farmers, because there's a waiting period for vegetables that there isn't for perennials. And just a lot of organic matter, we've got straw in our aisles, and we've got, we mulch with leaves, shredded leaves. And the perennials actually, you take a lot of fertility. I didn't realize that at first, until I really, created a new garden, cover cropped, and put the manure to it. And you really see a difference in the plants. So, it is important, even for home gardeners, to keep the fertility up.
How about the soil biology? It's not something I know a whole lot about. I don't know if either of you can talk more about.
I bet that's
stuff
Bill's
going on with the tiny bugs in.
Yeah, and I think again, you know, it comes to biodiversity of soil microbes as well, and with that is different food sources. So we make compost also. We farm with horses, so we have an abundance of horse manure and some chicken manure. To the compost pile, as it's breaking down and as the microbes are digesting that into compost, we'll add mineral amendments like aragonite or gypsum or granite dust. So those minerals get, you know, mixed in. Different populations of organisms form in there. We also grow plants in our gardens, such as comfrey, nettles, and yarrow, that are really well-suited to access nutrients that are locked up in the soil, making them more accessible to plants. So we'll cut those plants and mix them into the compost as well. Living near the coast, we can gather seaweed, so that goes in too. And so all these different food sources are stimulating different microbes and unlocking different nutrients for the plants. So, you know, I think that having the food source there really helps for the biological activity. And then also the mulching, especially around the perennials. And, you know, those beds tend to be less disturbed than the annual beds. And so keeping the disturbance down, keeping the soil covered up, that really tends to have a lot of positive effects for the microbes.
Great. I'd like to remind our listeners that you're listening to Common Ground. It's an hour on local food and agriculture hosted by MOFCA. Today we're talking about an ecological approach to gardening. We have with us Bill Erickson from Singing Nettle Farm in Brooks and Peter Beckford from Rebel Hill Farm in Clifton. And the phone lines aren't available today to call in, but you can, if you have questions or comments, you can send them to info@weru.org. So let's just keep on chugging here. We haven't talked much about the relationship between biodiversity in all the different natural systems and how that helps approach pest and disease management, or in another aspect of that question might be what are there certain pests or diseases that are indicators for you of something going on in your system that you can address, take a systems approach to rather than a product approach to?
We don't have a pest and disease problem. All I can think of really is, you know, there's a little worm that eats the leaves of aquilegia or columbine. It's like a cabbage worm. And, you know, we do BT on that, but that's just to keep them looking nice enough, you know, so that they can be sold and we know that we're not selling them with caterpillars that are going to strip the leaves. It doesn't even kill the plant. I mean, so the natives obviously don't have a problem. The goldenrods are doing great in Maine, and the asters are doing great. If there was an indicator in our garden, it would be the plants were like shorn to the ground, and clearly a tree would fall on the fence or something.
Much bigger pest involved.
Yeah. It's a deer or a turkey or a woodchuck. Yeah.
I think it, you know, really comes down to soil fertility again. And I think that's part of why a lot of the native plants don't have as many of the pest problems. One of the reasons anyway is because they've evolved suited to these soil conditions.
Yeah, that's right.
So when we're trying to grow most of our annual vegetable crops, they thrive in different conditions, you know, with, you know, high calcium, high phosphorus, really what we would call fertile soils. And then if you look at the role of insects in nature, it's basically there to eat and destroy plants that are sort of unfit for reproduction. So they're trying to get that genetic material out of the gene pool and stop it from continuing. Their antenna can actually sense when plants are off. So if a plant isn't made up of the right nutrients, it's going to give off a different frequency than a healthy plant. So everything's made up of the molecules and atoms and such. And so insects can perceive that, and they'll be drawn to a field of plants that are not put together properly, meaning that they don't have the right mineral makeup that they should. So getting the fertility right, is really the basis of it. Second to that, I think, is creating the right habitat for beneficial insects, predators like, wasps and spiders and lacewings and such. So find out what your problem pest is, then find out who eats that pest and create the habitat that supports the predator. So, perennial species, native species, just zones of the garden that can be left undisturbed and that provide a food source and a habitat for these other beneficial insects.
Great. We have another email question from, I'm not sure who it's from. So the question is, what can you say about rabbits in the system? Does their poop need to be composted? I'm guessing the compost poop, does the poop need to be composted question can probably be applied broader, not unless there's something I don't know specifically about rabbit feces.
Is this someone with domestic rabbits that's...
It's hard to say. Perhaps she can email again.
Yeah,
and
the rabbits that have been involved in our system have not been a good thing.
Right. Those would be the non-intentional rabbits. I have to assume that these are intentional rabbits.
I would assume their poop does need to be composted just like any other manure. And that's the way I'd do it.
Yeah, I think it would have a better effect composting it, and, you can work some minerals and other materials in through it, and that will actually, build up more of the microbial populations. I know for vegetables, at least, for being certified organic, there is a waiting period for putting fresh manure onto the field, so, composting it first is usually preferable.
And is there a kind of a law of conservation of nutrients with manure if you compost it and bring it up to temperature and manage it the right way? Are you going to, in the end, get a lot more benefit out of the available nutrients than if you're just applying
raw? That's not
raw?
My understanding.
No. Okay.
I mean, it's not...
I didn't know if there would be maybe more leaching involved,
right,
if you're just applying...
I mean, sure, I suppose.
Raw manure.
If you took the raw manure and spread it as is and it rained, yeah, maybe you would. Do you know, Bill?
I guess I look at it from the perspective, if you're putting mineral amendments on the field, something like gypsum or aragonite, calcium sources in particular that we're really low in this area, it's more efficient to digest it through the compost pile. So you can use less mineral amendments, working them through the compost pile, and then applying that supercharged compost to the field, as opposed to just applying, raw material minerals to the field.
Mm-hmm. Thanks. We have another question. Do you have any? Either of you have any Japanese beetle prevention tips? So I think I know what Peter's answer is going to be. We don't have any Japanese.
No,
beetles.
We sure do. Okay. They're a drag. One thing we've done is let the tall, wild, yellow primrose. Is that the plant? There's a trap plant in our garden, basically, for it. You pick your own trap plant. If there's something in your garden that they're going to. I mean, I know they love the hollyhocks. They will just, anything in the hollyhock family, I mean, they love it. And so we'll leave a weed that I'm blanking on the name of now, and collect.
You can call Julie later.
Yeah, I know. She'll probably email in. So that's about all that we can do. You know, as far as they don't, by and large, they're not attracted to the native perennials that we're growing. I can't think of any that they are, really. I mean, but they are a drag. Well, actually, no, they got on the echinacea. They'll mess up the blossoms and eat the leaves. I mean, they're on the corn. It's just, besides picking them, I don't have any advice.
So do you attempt to reduce the population in addition to having the trap crop in any way, or it's just hope that
collecting all those beetles off the trap plant.
You know, so you do collect them off the trap
plant?
Like
early in the morning, like a lot of bugs, they're not too agile. And
so you're not just feeding them so that they can reproduce and create more
Well, beetles. Sometimes we wonder if we are. I mean, right, but yeah.
Bill, do you have anything else to add about Japanese beetles?
Just as a general, you know, boosting the soil fertility for those plants, Japanese beetles are pretty pervasive. You know, they seem to always show up in one plant or another every year, but trying to get the fertility up of the plant so that they're less palatable for the beetles, and that if they do get chewed on a little bit, the plant is still strong enough and vigorous enough to grow through it.
Great. Another question came in by email. Do you have any suggestions that really work for slugs? This is from Jean in Belfast. They ate all my beans, most of my kale and greens.
Poor wow, Jean. That's a bad slug problem. I mean, all the standard stuff. They don't like crawling over sharp things. You know, they love going underneath boards.
What's sharp to a slug?
Ground up shells, okay. Seashells, diatomaceous earth. I don't know. With that bad a problem, I'd be looking for something to mulch with that they really didn't like.
Such as?
I mean, you could try, like, crushed shells. You know, mm-hmm. They feed that stuff to chickens or whatever. I don't know. I mean, I'd even think about... I don't like plastic mulch. But something that was just... that really made the ground clean in one way or another, that you could see the slugs. And you got any mm-hmm. ideas, Bill?
Well, we've been talking about all the benefits of mulch, and slugs really love mulch. They like to crawl under it, you know, straw mulch and such, and we've found that we have more of those in our mulched beds than not. So something that we'll do sometimes, especially for our annual crops, is to leave the beds unmulched early in the season to allow the soil to warm up and dry out a little bit when the plants are small, utilizing transplants and getting them to a big size first before setting them out, as opposed to direct seeding. It'll, you know, make the plant a little bigger, and even if a slug chews on it, it won't completely kill the plant. The other thing we use is Remay row covers with the wire hoops in the field. So as soon if there is a if you suspect a slug problem, or you have a plant that's particularly susceptible, as soon as you plant it out, cover it up and weight it down with rocks or a sandbag so there's no gaps. And it's not None of these approaches are 100% effective, but it should provide good results.
Combination of a few different things might.
Yeah, if they're little plants, I was thinking of larger plants. If they're little plants, I'd keep the ground clear around them, just as dry and clear as I could.
Bill, when I was on your website yesterday, I noticed that you mentioned that you use biodynamic practices as well. We haven't talked about biodynamic at all today, so... I wonder if you had anything additional to add about that particular philosophy, I guess, in relation to this conversation.
We use biodynamic preps in our compost pile and a biodynamic field spray in our fields. And
part, maybe even, sorry, taking a step back, what is biodynamic?
Well, it works on some of principles that basically we don't have a clear understanding of yet, but that plants are able to absorb different natural forces and vibrations that help them grow and stimulate life or decomposition, that are these sort of unseen forces in nature, and the preps are sort of almost like concentrated forms of that or similar vibrations to that to attract more of those forces. So whether it's aimed at decomposition or repelling disease or such, silica in horsetail is an example. There's a biodynamic prep that uses horsetail, and horsetail is very high in silica. And in biodynamics, silica is often regarded as a really important nutrient and the lacking of it to bring on disease. So the horsetail prep is a spray that can be used for fungal diseases to prevent those off. And it's just because the plant sort of embodies the energies and the vibrations of silica, it can be used to sort of trigger that in the plant that you're putting it onto.
Sounds like an area that could use some university-funded research to convince some of the skeptics.
That would be great. And in a lot of other countries around the world, it's, you know, it's pretty much more common and much more accepted in practice, and farmers are having, you know, excellent results and growing higher nutritious crops with less inputs from off the farm.
Well, we only have a few minutes left, so I want to give both of you an opportunity to share any final words or things that I maybe didn't ask about that you had to share with us today. Get the last opportunity to glean from your wisdom and knowledge.
I'll say some people are interested in reading on the subject. And some of our sources that we rely on are The Plants of Acadia National Park, which is a great book, came out a couple years ago with photos, and it's just a great plant to have in your backpack on a hike. And Growing and Propagating Wildflowers by Bill Kalina of NUF.
Okay, great. Thank you. Sorry, Bill, I'm not going to give you a chance to have a last word. I'd like to thank our guests, Bill Erickson and Peter Beckford, for joining us today, and also Amy Brown for engineering the show. Be sure to join us next month when we'll be discussing the genetically modified foods labeling legislation that's being considered this session in Maine, and that will be Friday, April 5th at 10 a.m. right here on your community radio, WERU-FM. Thanks for listening.
Support for WERU comes from Maine Farmland Trust, a member-supported nonprofit organization working to secure the future for farming in Maine, celebrating its new program.